Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the political crisis in Guinea-Bissau is deepening as the Economic Community of West African States withdraws its mediation team. Teenagers and young girls in Kenya are being coerced to sell sex live on TikTok.
I sell myself on TikTok. I dance naked, live. I do that because that's where I can earn money to support myself. When you're dancing live, some people will contact you.
What is the platform doing to clamp down on this? And South Africa's footballing star, Benning McCarthy, on divided loyalties as he becomes Kenya's national team coach.
Yeah, my heart might be with Bafana because it was the national team that gave me my first opportunity. It's my country. So, of course, I always will want them to do exceptionally well. But if we ever get to meet each other and I'm on the touchline in the Kenyan national team, then Bafana don't exist.
Oh, Benny, you are breaking millions of hearts, mine included. It's Tuesday, the 4th of March. First, we go to Guinea-Bissau. The political crisis there is deepening. President Umaro Sissoko Embalo has again postponed elections. They were due to be held last November. He postponed them till November this year. The issue is his mandate. The opposition say his term ended last week. He says it ends in September, and he is backed by a Supreme Court ruling. The Economic Community of West African States entered the fray when it sent a mediation team to try and help fix a date for the election. But President Embalo threatened to expel them, and now they've left. The opposition is angry, and the president is determined to press ahead with his plan. The region is jittery because Guinea-Bissau is prone to coups. President Embalo has survived two, one of them just a few months ago. And it is, in fact, the date of the first coup that has brought the nation to this crisis point. Parliament has been resolved, and an opposition call for a stay away has seen security forces out on the streets. Dr. Joseph Siegel is Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, and he's been filling me in on the details.
There were supposed to be elections in Guinea-Bissau in December of 2024. However, President Embalo abruptly canceled the elections in November for reasons that remain unclear. It appears that other than obviously wanting to extend his term, that this may be an opportunity for him to hold legislative elections prior to the presidential elections to see if his party can gain a majority and therefore help him in elections that are now scheduled for November of 2025. But, you know, this is part of a longer saga. The reason we are not clear on the date is that Embalo's term began controversially. He was elected in a second round in December of 2019. However, that was disputed. And in fact, the Supreme Court ruled that there were irregularities in that election and that there should be a recount. But the Election Commission was slow to comply to hold that recount. And in the meantime, Embalo self-appointed himself as the president. He conducted his own inauguration in a hotel in Bissau on February 26th. 2020. And so he effectively began his term in February 2020. And then after further legal debates and rulings, his term was then officially validated in September of 2020. And so the debate we're having today on when does the 5 years end comes back to how he began. So in such an irregular manner, the opposition is saying he's effectively been the president for 5 years, as of February 26th, whereas he says that his legal mandate didn't begin until September of 2020.
ECOWAS sent in a mediation mission to try and broker some sort of an agreement around the elections. They've now withdrawn the mission, and it's happened earlier than was expected. Is this them giving up, or is this them adding pressure, or is it just a case of they can see that it's not going anywhere, so they've left?
Well, it's not of them giving up. So ECOWAS has actually been a key actor in trying to help stabilize Guinea-Bissau over the years. And with the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel, they had a team deployed to the country during the week of February 21st to 28th to try to find some resolution to this controversy. And they were getting ready to propose their roadmap for a way forward for the 2020 elections when they felt threatened that Mbala was going to expel them from the country. So they left, but they're going to still present their roadmap to ECOWAS Secretariat in the coming days. And so their plan will be put out there ostensibly to find some compromise.
It seems like the president holds stronger cards than the opposition, certainly in this case, because they organized a nationwide strike over the weekend and it failed to gain steam because the opposition had promised to paralyze the country if the president refused to step down last week. And they said that his official mandate has ended. So is he in a much stronger position because of the failure of the strike to take hold?
Well, yes and no. I think, first of all, the strike failed to take hold because the military was deployed on the streets and they intimidated rally goers from participating. And there have been several other incidents since the failure to hold elections in December where the opposition has tried to organize and they've been intimidated by the security forces. And I think that's an important part of the story. Mbalo is a former brigadier general and he has been very close to the military throughout his time in office. In fact, it was the military that secured the hotel site when he first had his own self-designated inauguration. And so I think the fact that there wasn't strike wasn't that there isn't support for the opposition, but reflects that he does control the security forces. And so that's a defining feature of where we're at. But there remains a strong push for reform, a strong civil society that's trying to move Guinea-Bissau onto a more regular political platform moving forward.
What effect is all of this having on the people who are looking to voting towards the end of this year and also just the credibility of any process?
The question about credibility is very much front and center for what we're seeing. And despite all of its instability over the years, Guinea-Bissau has generally held fairly credible elections. That's why we've seen some alternation in who wins and which parties are in control. And, this is the real worry. I think we need to interpret what Mbalo is doing now within a whole context of how he's governed, where he suspended parliament multiple times. He's replaced the legislatively appointed prime minister to someone of his own suiting. He's replaced the head of the Supreme Court. He's operated with a shadow cabinet, whereas by constitution, it is the prime minister that's supposed to be managing the day-to-day affairs of the government. And so I think the concern for the opposition is that these postponements are just going to provide Mbalo more time to create an unlevel playing field that allows him to perpetuate his hold on power.
President Mbalo visited Moscow recently. Was it a deliberately chosen time? And does it signify something broader than just visiting another country?
I think it is significant. So Mbalo was in Moscow during the week when his term should have ended, according to the opposition. The week of February 27th. And it's significant because, Russia has been propping up different military leaders in the Sahel as a means of helping them stay in power through extra constitutional means. And the worry is that Mbalo is warming up to Moscow as a threat to the opposition that, he can secure other means of sustaining his time and power, and also as a pushback to ECOWAS that if they try to push him too hard, well, he can find partners outside that will enable him to maintain his control of the presidency.
Is this a sign, even though ECOWAS will still present its report and its roadmap, as it were, that its influence really is dead?
No, I wouldn't say that. ECOWAS continues to be a very important organization, in fact, the most important organization within the region. And especially in Guinea-Bissau, ECOWAS has been critical to maintaining the stability that we have seen. It has provided security support. It has provided institutional strengthening. It's helped to do all the capacity building that has enabled Guinea-Bissau to make the progress that it has. And so it remains very critical. And so this is not ECOWAS operating on its own. It has been trying to work collaboratively with Guinea-Bissau and with other partners to move Guinea-Bissau into a more normal institutional and political reality. And so I think they'll continue to have an important role in trying to find a resolution there.
That's Dr. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies.
Please elevate us with one hand at each. Just one
inbox for Kinembe, guys. Kinembe inbox.
That is a live stream on TikTok, where several young women in Kenya are using coded slang to advertise sexual services. During these live streams, icons of roses, cowboy hats, and money guns explode onto the screen. They represent money sent to the girls by those watching. TikTok takes a significant cut from gifts sent to them on the platform, and some of these girls are as young as 15. Esther, not her real name, who's now 17, says she was recruited to dance on TikTok Live 2 years ago.
I sell myself on TikTok. I dance naked, live. I do that because that's where I can earn money to support myself. When you're dancing live, some people will contact you.
Esther says the man who recruited her takes a cut of everything she earns and pressured her to have sex with him. The BBC spoke to whistleblowers from the company that moderates TikTok, and they say that TikTok knows that sexual content is being sold on the platform. The BBC's Debula Kemoli led the investigation. We began our conversation with her telling me how she came upon the issue.
I was spending hours on TikTok Lives to see what are these TikTok Lives about, and with time, I started to notice a pattern, especially around 11 p.m. midnight. The live stream starts to change their tone and what is happening. And you find loads of women sitting. And for a casual user, you might not really understand what's going on because sometimes they use slang or Swahili words. And usually they're soliciting and selling sexual content. And so it was women in a group being hosted by somebody, and some would be dancing provocatively, but some of them would just be hanging around. The worrying thing is that I learned that young children were also taking part in these live streams. But in terms of prevalence, you would go on one night and find up to 200 live streams of these young women just sitting there soliciting and selling sexual content. And the specific women we talked to for this documentary started when they were 15. So they were using TikTok Lives, as most teenagers do across the world, just to have fun. They were doing TikTok dance challenges, but didn't realize they were getting into this dark world where there were predators who eventually groomed them and eventually asked them to engage in nudity and do explicit sexual content. And sometimes, or often, that content would be shared on another platform, the extreme nudity, but often they were meeting these predators on TikTok and dancing on those live streams to get their customers.
And they get paid to do this?
That is the lure of TikTok. It promises a huge amount of money in the context of these girls' lives. So, for instance, a lot of them come from very poor neighborhoods. The two girls I spoke to, for instance, had not finished high school. So the potential for them gaining formal employment is very dim in their life. So they end up either working as housemaids or cleaning domestic workers. So that usually is around 200 shillings, which is around £1 or $2 a day. And so the potential of earning 10,000 Kenya shillings, which is around £100 a day through TikTok, it's luring. But then it gets much darker when they realize, or they end up having to meet these predators and having to engage.
In real life.
In real life, yes.
Before they can get the money that they think they're earning from dancing.
Often, yes. In the case of this particular girl I spoke to, who we are calling Esther, she had to meet her so-called digital pimp in real life, and he pressured her to have sex with him. She was raped at 15.
Mm-hmm. We're calling it digital prostitution and digital pimping, but essentially it's prostitution, it's coercion, it's grooming, it's a crime. What is TikTok doing about the content that is being shown on its platform?
So TikTok released a statement when we put these allegations to them. And they say TikTok has zero tolerance for exploitation. And we enforced strict safety policies, including robust live content rules, moderation in 70 languages, including Swahili. In terms of what they're doing, we spoke to a whistleblower who said they flag this content to TikTok and it's up to TikTok to take the content down.
TikTok actually knows what's happening in Kenya, but they're not doing anything to solve it. It's all about business. Live content that is sexual in nature tend to appear at night. I think they've started to cover nighttime, but moderation should never stop. There's also inefficiency of the artificial intelligence. The AI is not enough to select content which is pornographic or soliciting sex.
Is there any sign that some of the content, at least, maybe some of the ones that you've seen that had been reported, had actually been taken down?
You do notice sometimes some accounts have been taken down. So there are accounts I was following, for instance, in August last year, and I come back in November and they're no longer there. And you find that that person has opened a new account as backup. I don't know what happened exactly for those accounts to be taken down, but there is some work, obviously, behind the scenes when TikTok realizes the content is inappropriate.
Well, also, I suppose we need to look into what does the platform get out of this? Because, of course, it's driven by algorithms. It's driven by eyeballs. Is there any benefit for them?
When you go on TikTok Lives and you're getting gifts or you're being gifted, there's a lion, for instance, where that's around 54,000 Kenya shillings, which is around £300 or $400. That's a lot of money to earn in one live stream.
For somebody who doesn't have other prospects.
Yes, for somebody who doesn't have other prospects. But with 54,000 Kenya shillings, you can do a lot with that money. But what is being gifted to these content creators and on these live streams doesn't all get to the people who are doing this on those live streams. So we found when we did our investigation and we calculated how much is going to the content creators versus how much is going to TikTok, we found that the content creator only gets a 30%. So when we put this question to TikTok in the form of a right of reply, they didn't specifically address exactly how much they take. I do need to add, we did do our own investigation. We did gift people in Kenya, not just once, quite a few times to see exactly how much they received. And our investigation showed that TikTok was taking a 70% while the creators only received a 30% cut.
You spoke to three women. Tell me a little bit about what has been the impact of this on them.
It's very unfortunate, Audrey, that these are very young girls. And there was a pattern. In the area that I went, it seemed like these men, these predators, were targeting very young, vulnerable girls. And I think them meeting somebody who is promising them, oh, if you just dance, I'll get you 10,000 Kenya shillings, seemed like a simple thing to do for them, not realizing what they were getting into. And when they realized that the trap they'd fallen into, it had devastating consequences for their mental health, for their lives, not only because they were engaging in things that they would rather not do, but also some of them, their lives were being threatened if they wanted to come out of it. And one of the girls said, because I asked her, if you're able to raise that money, would you be able to leave? And she said, no, I feel like I'm in handcuffs because I will never be able to raise that money because every time I go on the live, he takes a cut.
And the he in this case is not TikTok, the platform. It's basically the pimp.
Exactly. So for instance, once, you know, TikTok have taken their percentage and then the digital pimp has also taken their percentage, then they end up with very little. So in this particular case, Esther, she told me that the pimp takes a big share of what she earns. And she actually does not know exactly how much she's earned whenever she does those lives. And she's sometimes there for 6-7 hours dancing. And then she ends up getting 3,000 Kenya shillings sometimes. That's like 20 pounds, $30. Not much.
What's the Kenyan government saying about this?
They didn't come back with an exact response. But in parliament, there have been petitions to call for a ban on TikTok. But the Kenyan government has rejected an outright ban, but have called for more moderation and regulation. I did speak to the Kenya Film Commission, which some of this falls within their remit because it's about images. And from what I know, they held conversations and were facilitating conversations with the TikTok regional office in Africa. But the Kenyan government wanted a TikTok office opened in Kenya so that they're closer to the ground and they can moderate better. But as far as I know, no TikTok office has been opened.
Is there any evidence that this could be happening in other African countries?
Since the documentary was released, there have been lots of comments reacting to the plight of the young Kenyan women and people also giving their experience and what they've seen on their platforms in their countries. For instance, I saw comments from people in Nigeria who were saying, you just touched the tip of the iceberg in Kenya. Come to Nigeria, you'll see much worse. So this gives me an indication that this is happening elsewhere in other countries as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Audrey.
That's my colleague, Debula Kemoli. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. One of the most recognizable names in African football, Benny McCarthy, is Kenya's new head coach. Benny is much loved, admired, and respected in South Africa for his glorious career as a striker, especially in the heyday of the national team back in the 1990s. He was named best player at the African Cup of Nations in 1998 and appeared in two World Cups for Bafana Bafana. He won the European Champions League playing for Porto in 2004, and he's played for Ajax in the Netherlands, as well as for West Ham United and Blackburn Rovers in the Premier League here in the UK. To crown it all, he was the first team coach with Manchester United. Not too shabby for a boy from the Cape Flats, one of the poorest areas in South Africa. And now he's moving to coaching on the continent, a trend that appears to be growing. Because in the past, national team coaches came from Europe or South America. Then the coaches came from the country they were coaching. We saw this in the 2022 Qatar World Cup, when all five African teams were led by homegrown coaches. Benny's appointment to the role in Kenya takes things a step further. He's from the continent, but not the country, and he says he can do it.
When we are football players, that we play in the best leagues in the world, the minute your football stops, to become a manager, to become a coach, or to become involved in leadership quality, we are not fit enough or we are not good enough for those kind of roles. For whatever reason it is, I don't know. We have the capabilities, it's just we're not given the opportunity. So now they are giving us the opportunity, and now we have to show everyone, we have to show the world, we have to show our own people for trusting us, believing us, that we can do it as good or maybe even better. Kenyan people are known for hard workers, they're known for being loyal, and that's the kind of national team that I want to give them. I want a national team that gives them exceptional hard work, you know? And when you watch this Kenyan team now that we're going to build, that we're going to put out there, it will be a team that people can relate to. That hardworking, that passion, that loyalty, but to be a winner, because they do it in athletics and then they become champions, they become winners. Now I want exactly the same for the football team. So the players that works under me must also have that same hungerness, that same desire, that same passion. When you put on that Kenyan shirt and you go, it's all out, there's all or nothing. You know, your hard, exceptional hard work comes with wearing that shirt. Because after a match, those people must be proud of you when you walk off that field.
I think the Harambee Stars are going to start shining much brighter with Benny on the touchline. But I'm biased. BBC Africa sport reporter Calvin Kimathi spoke to Benny about his new job. So I asked him how significant this appointment is.
Very significant, not only for Kenya, which is aiming to sort of revitalize their football, but also the whole continent. The belief in African coaches and McCarthy's appointment is seen by many as part of a larger narrative of growth and potential within African football. His transition from a successful career as a player and now to coach sort of mirrors the journeys of many football legends, contributing to a legacy of homegrown talent. And as he takes up his new role, his leadership skills and wealth of experience will be very, very key for the Harambee Stars and also for Africa. He becomes now the eighth African coach leading an African team, national team, even though not for his country where he was born, but still very critical in terms of growing and believing in African coaches. So it's quite a milestone and significant.
Why do you think Benny did it? I mean, he had a fantastically successful run as a player. He was very, very popular in South Africa. I should know. We all adore him. He was a very successful coach at Manchester United, which is one of the biggest clubs in the world. he's going to Harambe Stars, not known. The name doesn't trip off the lips of football lovers. It's not very well known. So what's in it for him?
I put that same question to Benny, and one of the things he referred to is he's had an incredible opportunity to work with, as you mentioned, Manchester United and other clubs, and did really well. But remember, Benny has never coached a national team side. So this is his first assignment as a national team head coach and of a country that's going to host one of the biggest or major football tournaments in the world, the Africa Cup of Nations in 2027. Kenya is part of a partner host with the other East African countries. So looking forward to that. And also him missing the touchline. After he left Manchester United, he has been in South Africa for a while, hasn't been with any team, and he sort of missed that adrenaline and being on the touchline, working on the players to improve the players. But also, his good relationship with the Football Kenya Federation Vice President, McDonald Mariga, UEFA Champions League winner, and played with Benny McCarthy during his playing days. So he sort of is familiar with our leadership. He's African. Our culture and the South African culture is not that far apart. So it's sort of home. Kenya is sort of also home for Benny McCarthy, according to what he was telling me, convinced him to take this. But most importantly, it's the desire to improve players, the desire to want to lead an African team in a major African tournament, the desire to want to be on the touchline during the Africa Cup of Nations leading an African team or at the World Cup.
He's actually in a very good position, I think, to nurture young up-and-coming players, young up-and-coming teams, because he benefited from excellent coaches throughout his career. Speaking of coaches, African national teams and African clubs haven't always embraced homegrown talent. Benny is the latest in what seems to be a growing trend. In 2022 at the Qatar World Cup, there were 5 African nations in the tournament and they were led by African coaches, something which had actually not happened before. So is this the beginning of a growing trend, or is it just a case of flash in the pan? It's just happening now and it's not necessarily being built upon.
It is a beginning of something larger, and you can sort of track it back to even the last Africa Cup of Nations. You know, the number of African coaches that were there were around 7, and you can see the growth of these teams and the coaches. For example, Leo Cisse winning the Africa Cup of Nations with Senegal and also Algeria's coach. This sort of built that trust that, yes, African coaches are good enough and they're doing well. They're well qualified as players. They compete in some of the biggest football stages in the world. They won major tournaments, UEFA Champions League and the rest. So why can't we trust them and hold them to that same standards that we hold to them when they are players and achieving all these amazing things at a global stage? But also, it's wider than just the achievements of these coaches and what they can do on the pitch. It's also off the pitch. They understand the African football dynamics. They understand our culture, the food. They do understand the intriguing challenges that comes with coaching an African team, from financial challenges, from players, from everything. So they're sort of able to bond with the players more because in their playing days, they faced these same challenges. They know how best to navigate this, and they also know how best to use the available resources to make the best of what's available. And that gives them an edge than any other foreign coach.
Fans always are invested in these movements. They've long criticized the African Federation for not encouraging homegrown coaching talent. How are they responding? Not just to Benny's appointment, because I think, you know, people would be very happy with that, but with the trend in general.
Majority are happy, especially when you talk about a big name like Benny McCarthy, a legend. He's coming off straight from Manchester United, where he's been dealing with some of the top talents in the world. And for him sort of giving back that wealth of knowledge and expertise that he's coming with, it's definitely going to transform our football, Africa as a whole. And most of the fans are really embracing these having home coaches. Because I remember before even Benny McCarthy's appointment, once the former Kenyan coach, Engin Firat, left, everyone was saying that we need a Kenyan coach or an African coach. We don't need to go for a foreign coach who has nothing much to show for, haven't coached any bigger teams and pay a lot of money, yet they don't understand our players, they don't understand the language, they don't understand the tradition, most of them, and all the other challenges that come with that. So the fans are also sort of warming up to that and accepting widely that truly, with the challenges that we have, an African coach is way better off than a foreign coach.
Ben, you, as we were saying, was recently with Manchester United here in the UK, and he was working with former manager Erik ten Hag. So I'm wondering whether him working here as a coach in the UK and then going to Africa is also a sign of growing confidence in countries of the Premier League and elsewhere, that African coaches actually have what it takes. And not just that, but giving them the opportunities to show that they have what it takes.
Definitely. This is sort of giving those opportunities and sort of also proving to the world that, yes, Africa can do it. They've done it as players. Why can they do it as coaches? There's a lot that is expected of from Benny, and there's a lot of pressure also, bearing in mind that if coming from Manchester United, everyone is using that tag. So they expect him to sort of do some miracles and miraculous work. Looking at his track record, what he did with AmaZulu, what he's done in South Africa, also getting to the level to coaching Manchester United, also his career as a football player, he definitely has what it takes.
BBC Africa sport reporter Calvin Kimathi. But let's hear from Benny again. He says he's going to surprise people by getting their Harambee Stars to the 2026 World Cup. But those of us who are used to seeing Benny in the 18 area are a bit conflicted about him on the touchline for Kenya. He is, after all, Bafana Bafana's all-time record goal scorer. How will he cope when the Harambee Stars face his beloved Bafana Bafana?
Yeah, my heart might be with Bafana because it was the national team that gave me my first opportunity. It's my country. So, of course, I always will want them to do exceptionally well, the best that they could possibly do. But if we ever get to meet each other and I'm on the touchline in the Kenya national team, then Bafana don't exist.
Now, in the interest of Pan-Africanism, we are all going to have to deal with this. But to give you a taste of how well-loved Benny is, here's a song written by the Kwaito group TKZ. It's called Shibobo, a football term in South Africa that translates as nutmeg. You know that move when a masterful player pushes the ball through the legs of an attacking opponent, making him look silly? That's a shibobo. And that's Benny Alexander wrapping it up with Shibobo, the song by TKZ. Focus on Africa was painstakingly stitched together by Nyasha Michelle, Sunita Nahar and Bella Hassan here in London. Blessing Aderogba delivered her handiwork from Lagos. Patricia Whitehorn was the senior journalist in charge. Our technical producer was Gabriel O'Regan. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.